I'm not wired, Eleanor, he said. I'm here for myself. I want to know for myself.
That's not what I was looking at, she said. I knew you wouldn't be wired. I was thinking of your arm. Harry, if there's anything that you believe about me now, that you can believe, believe me when I say no one was supposed to get hurt. No one... Everybody was to lose, but that was all. After that day, at the memorial, I looked and I searched and I found out what happened to my brother. I used Ernst at State, I used the Pentagon, my father, I used whatever I could, and I found out about my brother.
She searched his eyes, but he tried not to reveal the thoughts behind them. And?
And it was like Ernst told us. Toward the end of the war, the three captains, the triad, were taking an active part in the transport of heroin to the States. One conduit was Rourke and his crew at the embassy, the military police. That included Meadows, Delgado, and Franklin. They would find short-timers in the bars in Saigon and proposition them. A few $1,000 to take a sealed diplomatic package through customs, nothing to it. They could arrange for them to receive temporary courier status, put them on a plane, and somebody would be waiting for the package in L.A. My brother was one of those that accepted. But Michael had a plan. It didn't take a genius to figure out what they were carrying, and so he must have thought he could get over here and make a better deal with somebody else. I don't know how far he thought it out or had it set up, but it didn't matter. They found him and they killed him.
They?
I don't know who. People working for the captains? For Rourke? It was perfect. He was killed in a way that the army, his family, just about everybody would want to keep quiet. So it was quickly tidied up, and that was that.
Bosch sat next to her as she told the rest of the story and did not interrupt until it was done, until it had come out of her like a demon. She said the first one she found was Rourke. He was, to her astonishment, in the bureau. She called in her markers and transferred from D.C. out to his crew. She had a different last name than her brother had. Rourke didn't know who she was. After that, Meadows, Franklin, and Delgado were located easily enough in prisons. They weren't going anywhere.
Rourke was the key, she said. I went to work on him. I guess you could say I seduced him with the plan.
Bosch felt something tear loose inside, some final feeling for her.
I clearly insinuated that I wanted to make a score. I knew he would go for it because he'd been corrupt for years, and he was greedy. One night he told me about the diamonds, how he had helped these two guys out of Saigon with boxes full of diamonds. It was Tran and Bin. From there it was easy to plan the whole thing. Rourke recruited the other three and pulled some strings, anonymously, to get them early releases into Charlie Company. It was a perfect plan, and Rourke actually thought it was his. That's what made it perfect. In the end, I was going to disappear with the treasure. Bin and Tran would be robbed of the fortune they had spent their lives collecting and hoarding, and the other four would taste the biggest score of their lives and have it taken away. It would be the best way of hurting them the most. But no one outside the circle of guilt was to get hurt. Things just happened.
Meadows took the bracelet, Bosch said.
Yes, Meadows took the bracelet. I saw it on the pawn list that got sent over from LAPD. It was routine, but I panicked. Those lists go to every burglary unit in the county. I thought it would get noticed by somebody. Meadows would be pulled in and spill the story. I told Rourke, and he panicked too. He waited until they were pretty much done with the second tunnel, and then he and the two others confronted Meadows. I wasn't there.
Her eyes were fixed on a point far away. There was no emotion in her voice anymore. It was just a flat line. Bosch didn't have to prompt her. The rest just came out.
I wasn't there, she said again. Rourke called me. He told me that, you know, Meadows died without giving up the pawn ticket. He said he'd made it look like an overdose. The bastard actually said that he knew people who had done it before, a long time ago, and gotten away with it. You see, he was talking about my brother. When he said that, I knew I was doing the right thing. Anyway, he needed my help. They had searched Meadows' place and couldn't find the pawn stub. That meant Delgado and Franklin were going to break into the shop and get the bracelet back. But Rourke wanted my help with Meadows, the body. He didn't know what to do with it.
She said she knew from Meadows' record that he had been busted for loitering at the reservoir. It wasn't difficult for her to convince Rourke it was a good place to leave the body.
But I also knew that the reservoir was Hollywood Division, that if you didn't get the call, you would at least hear about it and probably take an interest after Meadows was ID'd. See, I knew about you and Meadows, and now I knew Rourke was out of control. You were the safety valve, in case I needed to bring the whole thing down. I couldn't let Rourke get away with it again.
She swept her gaze across the stones and absent-mindedly raised a hand and dropped it in her lap, a small show of resignation.
After we put his body in the jeep and covered it with the blanket, Rourke went back in to make a last sweep of the place. I stayed outside. There was a tire iron in the back. I took it in his fingers with it. Meadows' fingers. It was so somebody would see it was murder. I remember the sound so clearly. The bone. So loud I thought Rourke might even have heard.
What about Sharky? Bosch asked.
Sharky,
she said wistfully, as if she were trying the name out for the first time.
After the interview, I told Rourke that Sharky didn't see our faces at the dam. He even thought I was a man sitting in the jeep. But I made a mistake. I mentioned how we discussed hypnotizing him. Even though I stopped you and trusted that you wouldn't do it without me, Rourke didn't trust you. So he did what he did with Sharky. After we were called out there and I saw him, I...
She didn't finish, but Bosch wanted to know everything. You what?
Later, I confronted Rourke and told him I was bringing the whole thing down because he was out of control, killing innocent people. He told me there was no way to stop it. Franklin and Delgado were in the tunnel and out of reach. They turned the radios off when they brought the C-4 in. It's too unstable. He said there was no way stopping it without more spilled blood. Then the next night, you and I were almost run down. That was Rourke, I'm sure.
She said that the two of them played an unspoken game of mutual distrust and suspicion after that. The burglary of Beverly Hills Safe and Lock continued as planned, and Rourke steered Bosch and everybody else away from going underground to stop it. He had to let Franklin and Delgado go through with it, even though there were no diamonds left in Tron's box. Rourke could not risk going underground to warn them either. Eleanor finally ended the game when she followed Bosch down into the tunnel and killed Rourke, his eyes staring at her as he slid down into the black water.
"And that's the whole story,"
she said quietly. "My car's over this way," Bosch said as he stood up from the bench. "I'll take you back now." They found his car on the driveway, and Bosch noticed her eyes linger on the fresh soil on Meadows' grave before she got in. He wondered if she had watched from the federal building as the casket was put in the ground. As he drove toward the exit, Harry said,
"Why couldn't you let it go?
What happened to your brother was another time, another place. Why didn't you let it go?"
"You don't know how many times I've asked that, and how many times I didn't know the answer. I still don't."
They were at the light at Wilshire, and Bosch was wondering what he was going to do. And once again she read him. She sensed his indecision.
"Are you going to take me in now, Harry? You might have a hard time proving your case. Everybody's dead. It could look like you were part of it, too. You going to risk that?"
He didn't say anything. The light changed, and he drove down to the federal building, pulling to the curb near the Garden of Flags. She said,
"If it means anything to you at all, what happened between you and me wasn't part of any plan. I know you won't ever know if that's the truth, but I wanted to say..."
"Don't," he said. "Don't say a thing about it." A few uneasy moments of silence passed between them.
"You're just letting me go here?"
"I think it would be best for you, Eleanor, if you turned yourself in. Go get a lawyer and then come in. Tell them you didn't have anything to do with the murders. Tell them the story about your brother. They're reasonable people and they'll want to keep it low profile, avoid the scandal. The U.S. attorney will probably let you plead to something short of murder. The Bureau will go along."
"And what if I don't turn myself in? You will tell them?"
"No. Like you said, I'm too much a part of it. They'd never go with what I'd tell them.
He thought a long moment. He didn't want to say what he was going to say next unless he was sure he meant it, and could, and would, do it.
No, I won't tell them. But if I don't hear in a few days that you went in, I will tell Bin. And I'll tell Tron. I won't need to prove it to them. I'll just tell them the story with enough facts that they'll know it's true. Then, you know what they'll do? They'll act like they don't know what the hell I'm talking about, and they'll tell me to get out. And then they'll come after you, Eleanor, looking for the same kind of justice you got for your brother.
You would do that, Harry?
I said I would. I'll give you 2 days to go in, then I tell them the story.
She looked at him, and the pained expression on her face asked why.
Harry said, "Somebody has to answer for Sharky."
She turned away, put her hand on the door handle, and looked out the car window at the flags flapping in the Santa Ana breeze. She didn't look back at him when she said, "So I guess I was wrong about you."
"If you mean the Dollmaker case, the answer is yes. You were wrong about me."
She looked back at him with a wan smile as she opened the door. She quickly leaned over and kissed him on the cheek. She said, "Bye, Harry Bosch."
Then she was out of the car, standing in the wind and looking in at him. She hesitated and then closed the door. As Harry drove away, he glanced once in the mirror and saw her still at the curb. She stood there looking down like someone who had dropped something in the gutter. After that, he didn't look back.
Epilogue. The morning after Memorial Day, Harry Bosch checked back into MLK, where he was severely chastised by his doctor, who seemed, to Harry at least, to take a perverse pleasure in ripping the home-applied bandages away from his shoulder and then using a stinging saline solution to rinse the wound. He spent 2 days resting and then was wheeled into the OR for surgery to reattach muscles that had been torn from bone by the bullet. On the second day of his recovery from surgery, a nurse's aide dropped off a day-old Los Angeles Times for him to while away a few hours with. Bremer's story was on the front page, and it accompanied a photograph of a priest standing before a lonely casket at a cemetery in Syracuse, New York. It was FBI Special Agent John Rourke's casket. Bosch could tell from the photo that more mourners, albeit members of the media, had been at Meadows' funeral. But Bosch tossed the front section aside after scanning the first few paragraphs of the story and realizing it wasn't about Eleanor. He turned to the sports. The next day he had a visitor. Lieutenant Harvey Pounds told Bosch that when he was recovered he would report back to Hollywood Homicide. Pounds said that neither of them had any choice in the matter. The order came from the 6th floor at Parker Center. The lieutenant didn't have much else to say, and didn't mention the newspaper article at all. Harry took the news with a smile and a nod, not wanting to show a hint of what he felt or thought. "Of course, this is all contingent on you being able to pass a departmental physical when you're released by your physicians here," Pounds added.
"Of course," Bosch said.
"You know, Bosch, some officers would want the disability. Retire at 80% pay. You could get a job in the private sector and do very nicely. You'd deserve it."
Ah, Harry thought, there is the reason for the visit.
"Is that what the department wants me to do, Lieutenant?" he asked. "Are you the messenger?"
"Of course not. The department wants you to do what you want, Harry. I'm just looking at the advantages of the situation. You know, just something to think about. I understand private investigation is the growth market of the 90s. No trust anymore, you know. Nowadays people are secretly getting complete backgrounds, medical, financial, romantic, on the people they're going to marry."
"That doesn't sound like my kind of work."
"You'll take the homicide table, then?"
"As soon as I pass the physical."
He had another visitor the next day. This one was expected. She was a prosecutor from the U.S. Attorney's Office. Her name was Chavez, and she wanted to know about the night Sharky was killed. Eleanor Wish had come in, Bosch knew then. He told the prosecutor that he had been with Eleanor, confirming her alibi.
Chavez said she just had to check to be sure before they started talking a deal. She asked a few other questions about the case, then got up from the visitor's chair to go.
"What's going to happen to her?" Bosch asked.
"I can't discuss that, Detective."
"Off the record?"
"Off the record, she's obviously going to have to go away, but it probably won't be long. The climate is right for this to be handled very quietly. She came forward. She brought competent counsel, and it appears she was not directly responsible for the deaths involved. If you ask me, she'll get out of this very lucky. She'll plead and do maybe 30 months, tops, up at Tehachapi."
Bosch nodded, and Chavez was gone.
Harry, too, was gone the next day, sent home for 6 weeks' recuperative leave before reporting back to the station on Wilcox. When he had arrived at the house on Woodrow Wilson, he found a yellow slip of paper in his mailbox. He took it to the post office and exchanged it for a wide, flat package in brown paper. He didn't open it until he was home. It was from Eleanor Wish, though it did not say so. It was just something he knew. After tearing away the paper and bubbled plastic liner, he found a framed print of Hopper's Nighthawks. It was the piece he had seen above her couch that first night he was with her. Bosch hung the print in the hallway near his front door, and from time to time he would stop and study it when he came in, particularly from a weary day or night on the job. The painting never failed to fascinate him, or to evoke memories of Eleanor Wish. The darkness, the stark loneliness, the man sitting alone, his face turned to the shadows. "I am that man," Harry Bosch would think each time he looked.
This book is over, but the story continues. Keep listening after the credits to hear the beginning of The Black Ice, Book 2 in the Harry Bosch series, free.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Black Echo by Michael Connelly, copyright 1992 by Michael Connelly, and performance copyright 1998 by Brilliance Corporation, all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Corporation, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
And now, a free preview of The Black Ice, Book 2 in the Harry Bosch series.
The smoke carried up from the Cahuenga Pass and flattened beneath a layer of cool crossing air. From where Harry Bosch watched, the smoke looked like a gray anvil rising up the pass. The late afternoon sun gave the gray a pinkish tint at its highest point, tapering down to deep black at its root, which was a brush fire moving up the hillside on the east side of the cut. He switched his scanner to the Los Angeles County Mutual Aid frequency and listened as firefighter battalion chiefs reported to a command post that 9 houses were already gone on one street and those on the next street were in the path. The fire was moving toward the open hillsides of Griffith Park, where it might make a run for hours before being controlled. Harry could hear the desperation in the voices of the men on the scanner. Bosch watched the squadron of helicopters, like dragonflies from this distance, dodging in and out of the smoke, dropping their payloads of water and pink fire retardant on burning homes and trees. It reminded him of the dust-offs in Vietnam, the noise, the uncertain bobbing and weaving of the overburdened craft. He saw the water crushing through flaming roofs and steam immediately rising. He looked away from the fire and down into the dried brush that carpeted the hillside and surrounded the pylons that held his own home to the hillside on the west side of the pass. He saw daisies and wildflowers in the chaparral below, but not the coyote he had seen in recent weeks hunting in the arroyo below his house. He had thrown down pieces of chicken to the scavenger on occasion, but the animal never accepted the food while Bosch watched. Only after Bosch went back in off the porch would the animal creep out and take the offerings. Harry had christened the coyote Timido. Sometimes late at night he heard the coyote's howl echoing up the pass. He looked back out at the fire just as there was a loud explosion, and a concentrated ball of black smoke rotated up within the gray anvil. There was excited chatter on the scanner, and a battalion chief reported that a propane tank from a barbecue had ignited. Harry watched the darker smoke dissipate in the larger cloud, and then switched the scanner back to the LAPD tactical frequencies. He was on call. Christmas duty. He listened for a half minute, but heard nothing other than routine radio traffic. It appeared to be a quiet Christmas in Hollywood. He looked at his watch and took the scanner inside. He pulled a pan out of the oven and slid his Christmas dinner, a roasted breast of chicken, onto a plate. Next, he took the lid off a pot of steamed rice and peas and dumped a large portion onto the plate. He took his meal out to the table in the dining room, where there was already a glass of red wine waiting, next to the three cards that had come in the mail earlier in the week, but that he had left unopened. He had Coltrane's arrangement of Song of the Underground Railroad on his CD player. As he ate and drank, he opened the cards, studied them briefly, and thought of their senders. This was the ritual of a man who was alone, he knew, but it didn't bother him. He'd spent many Christmases alone. The first card was from a former partner who had retired on book and movie money and moved to Ensenada. It said what Anderson's cards always said. Harry, when you coming down? The next one was also from Mexico. From the guide, Harry had spent 6 weeks living and fishing and practicing Spanish with the previous summer in Bahia San Felipe. Bosch had been recovering from a bullet wound in the shoulder. The sun and sea air helped him mend. In his holiday greeting, written in Spanish, Jorge Barrera also invited Bosch's return. The last card Bosch opened slowly and carefully, also knowing who it was before seeing the signature. It was postmarked Tehachapi, and so he knew. It was hand-printed on off-white paper from the prison's recycling mill, and the nativity scene was slightly smeared. It was from a woman he had spent one night with, but thought about on more nights than he could remember. She, too, wanted him to visit, but they both knew he never would. He sipped some wine and lit a cigarette. Coltrane was now into the live recording of Spiritual, captured at the Village Vanguard in New York when Harry was just a kid. But then the radio scanner, still playing softly on a table next to the television, caught his attention. Police scanners had played for so long as the background music of his life that he could ignore the chatter, concentrate on the sound of a saxophone, and still pick up the words and codes that were unusual. What he heard was a voice saying, 1K12, Staff 2 needs your 20. Bosch got up and walked over to the scanner, as if looking at it would make his broadcast more clear. He waited 10 seconds for a reply to the request. 20 seconds.
Staff 2, location is the Hideaway, western, south of Franklin, room 7. Staff 2 should bring a mask.
Bosch waited for more, but that was it. The location given, Western and Franklin, was within Hollywood Division's boundaries. 1K12 was a radio designation for a homicide detective out of the downtown headquarters Parker Center, the Robbery Homicide Division. And Staff 2 was the designation for an assistant chief of police. There were only 3 ACs in the department, and Bosch was unsure which one was Staff 2, but it didn't matter. The question was, what would one of the highest-ranking men in the department be rolling out for on Christmas night? A second question bothered Harry even more. If RHD was already on the call, why hadn't he, the on-call detective in Hollywood Division, been notified first? He went to the kitchen, dumped his plate in the sink, dialed the station on Wilcox, and asked for the watch commander. A lieutenant named Kleinman picked up. Bosch didn't know him. He was new, a transfer out of Foothill Division.
"What's going on?" Bosch asked. "I'm hearing on the scanner about a body at Western and Franklin, and nobody's told me a thing, and that's funny, because I'm on call out today."
Kleinman said,
"Don't worry about it. The hats have got it all squared away."
Kleinman must be an old-timer, Bosch figured. He hadn't heard that expression in years. Members of RHD wore straw bowlers in the 1940s. In the 50s, it was gray fedoras. Hats went out of style after that. Uniformed officers called RHD detectives suits now, not hats, but not homicide special cops. They still thought they were the tops, up there high like a cat's ass. Bosch had hated that arrogance, even when he'd been one of them.
One good thing about working Hollywood, the city's sewer, nobody had any airs. It was police work, plain and simple.
What's the call? Bosch asked.
Kleiman hesitated a few seconds and then said,
We've got a body in a motel room on Franklin. It's looking suicide, but RHD is going to take it. I mean, they've already taken it. We're out of it. That's from on high, Bosch.
Bosch said nothing. He thought a moment. RHD coming out on a Christmas suicide? It didn't make much. Then it flashed to him. Calexico Moore.
How old is this thing? He asked. I heard them tell Staff 2 to bring a mask.
Well, it's ripe. They said it'd be a real potato head. Problem is, there isn't much head left. Looks like he smoked both barrels of a shotgun. At least that's what I'm picking up on the RHD freak.
Bosch's scanner did not pick up the RHD frequency. That was why he had not heard any of the early radio traffic on the call. The suits had apparently switched freaks only to notify Staff 2's driver of the address. If not for that, Bosch would not have heard about the call until the following morning when he came into the station. This angered him, but he kept his voice steady. He wanted to get what he could from Kleiman.
It's Moore, isn't it?
Looks like it. The shield is on the bureau there, wallet. But like I said, nobody's going to make a visual ID from the body, so nothing is for sure.
How did this all go down?
Look, Bosch, I'm busy here. You know what I mean? This doesn't concern you. RHD has it.
No, you're wrong, man. It does concern me. I should have gotten first call from you. I want to know how it went down so I understand why I didn't.
All right, Bosch. It went like this. We get a call out from the owner of the dump, says he's got a stiff in the bathroom of room 7. We send a unit out, and they call back and say, yeah, we got the stiff. But they call back on a landline, no radio, because they saw the badge and the wallet on the bureau and knew it was Moore, or at least thought it was him. Anyway, I called Captain Grupa at home, and he called the AC. The hats were called in, and you were not. That's the way it goes. So if you have a beef, it's with Grupa or maybe the AC. Not me. I'm clean.
Bosch didn't say anything. He knew that sometimes when he was quiet, the person he needed information from would eventually fill the silence.
It's out of our hands now. Shit, the TV and Times are out there. Daily News. They figure it's Moore like everybody else. It's a big mess. You'd think the fire up on the hill would be enough to keep them occupied. No way. They're out there lined up on Western. I gotta send another car over for media control. So, Bosch, you should be happy you aren't involved. It's Christmas, for Christ's sake.
But that wasn't good enough. Bosch should have been called, and then it should have been his decision when to call out RHD. Someone had taken him out of the process altogether, and that still burned him. He said goodbye and lit another cigarette. He got his gun out of the cabinet above the sink and hooked it to the belt on his blue jeans. Then he put on a light tan sport coat over the army green sweater he was wearing. It was dark outside now, and through the sliding glass door he could see the fire line across the pass. It burned brightly on the black silhouette of the hill. It was a crooked devil's grin moving to the crest. From out in the darkness below his house he heard the coyote, howling at the rising moon, or the fire, or maybe just at himself, for being alone and in the dark. 2. Bosch drove down out of the hills into Hollywood, traveling mostly on deserted streets until he reached the boulevard. On the sidewalks there were the usual groupings of runaways and transients. There were strolling prostitutes. He saw one with a red Santa hat on. Business is business, even on Christmas night. There were elegantly made-up women sitting on bus benches who were not really women and not really waiting for buses. The tinsel and Christmas lights strung across the boulevard at each intersection added a surreal touch to the neon glitz and grime. Like a whore with too much makeup, he thought, if there was such a thing. But it wasn't the scene that depressed Bosch. It was Cal Moore. Bosch had been expecting this for nearly a week, since the moment he heard that Moore had failed to show up for roll call. For most of the cops at Hollywood Division, it wasn't a question of whether Moore was dead, it was just a question of how long before his body turned up. Moore had been a sergeant heading up the division's street narcotics unit. It was a night job, and his unit worked the boulevard exclusively. It was known in the division that Moore had separated from his wife and replaced her with whiskey. Bosch had found that out firsthand, the one time he had spent time with the narc. He had also learned that there might be something more than just marital problems and early burnout plaguing him. Moore had spoken obliquely of internal affairs and a personnel investigation. It all added up to a heavy dose of Christmas depression. As soon as Bosch heard they were starting a search for Cal Moore, he knew. The man was dead. And so did everyone else in the department, though nobody said this out loud. Not even the media said it. At first, the department tried to handle it quietly. Discreet questions at Moore's apartment in Los Feliz, a few helicopter runs over the nearby hills in Griffith Park. But then a TV reporter was tipped, and all the other stations and the newspapers followed the story for the ride. The media dutifully reported on the progress of the search for the missing cop. Moore's photograph was pinned to the bulletin board in the Parker Center press room, and the weight of the department made the standard pleas to the public. It was drama. Or at least it was good video. Horseback searches, air searches, the police chief holding up the photo of the darkly handsome and serious-looking sergeant. But nobody said they were looking for a dead man. Bosch stopped the car for the light at Vine and watched a man wearing a sandwich board cross the street. His stride was quick and jerky, and his knees continuously popped the cardboard sign up in the air. Bosch saw there was a satellite photograph of Mars pasted on the board with a large section of it circled. Written in large letters below was, "Repent, the face of the Lord watches us." Bosch had seen the same photograph on the cover of a tabloid while standing in line at a Lucky store, but the tabloid had claimed the face was that of Elvis. The light changed and he continued on toward Western. He thought of Moore. Outside of one evening spent drinking with him at a jazz bar near the boulevard, he had not had much interaction with Moore. When Bosch had been transferred to Hollywood Division from RHD the year before, there had been hesitant handshakes and glad-to-know-yous from everyone in the division. But people generally kept their distance. It was understandable, since he had been rolled out of RHD on an IAD beef, and Bosch didn't mind. Moore was one of those who didn't go out of his way to do much more than nod when they passed in the hall or saw each other at staff meetings. Which was also understandable, since the homicide table where Bosch worked was in the First Floor Detective Bureau, and Moore's squad, the Hollywood Bang, short for Boulevard Anti-Narcotics Group, was on the second floor of the station. Still, there had been the one encounter. For Bosch, it had been a meeting to pick up some background information for a case he was working. For Moore, it had been an opportunity to have many beers and many whiskeys. Moore's Bang Squad had the kind of slick, media-grabbing name the department favored, but in reality was just five cops working out of a converted storage room and roaming Hollywood Boulevard at night, dragging in anybody with a joint or better in his pocket. Bang was a numbers squad, created to make as many arrests as possible in order to help justify requests for more manpower, equipment, and most of all, overtime in the following year's budget. It did not matter that the DA's office handed out probation deals on most of the cases and kicked the rest. What mattered were those arrest statistics. And if Channel 2 or 4 or a Times reporter from the West Side Insert wanted to ride along one night and do a story on the Bang Squad, all the better. There were numbers squads in every division. At Western, Bosch turned north, and ahead he could see the flashing blue and yellow lights of the patrol cars and the lightning-bright strobes of TV cameras. In Hollywood, such a display usually signaled the violent end of a life or the premiere of a movie. But Bosch knew nothing premiered in this part of town except 13-year-old hookers. Bosch pulled to the curb a half block from the hideaway and lit a cigarette. Some things about Hollywood never changed. They just came up with new names for them. The place had been a rundown dump 30 years ago when it was called the El Rio. It was a rundown dump now. Bosch had never been there, but he had grown up in Hollywood and remembered. He had stayed in enough places like it, with his mother, when she was still alive. The hideaway was a 1940s-era courtyard motel that during the day would be nicely shaded by a large banyan tree which stood in its center. At night, the motel's 14 rooms receded into a darkness only the glow of red neon invaded. Harry noticed that the E in the sign announcing monthly rates was out. When he was a boy, and the hideaway was the El Rio, the area was already in decay. But there wasn't as much neon, and the buildings, if not the people, looked fresher, less grim. There had been a streamlined, modern office building that looked like an ocean liner docked next to the motel. It had set sail a long time ago, and another mini-mall was there now. Looking at the hideaway from his parked car, Harry knew it was a sorry place to stay the night. A sorrier place to die. He got out and headed over. Yellow crime scene tape was strung across the mouth of the courtyard and was manned by uniformed officers. At one end of the tape, bright lights from TV cameras focused on a group of men in suits. The one with the gleaming, shaven scalp was doing all the talking. As Bosch approached, he realized that the lights were blinding them. They could not see past the interviewers. He quickly showed his badge to one of the uniforms, signed his name on the crime scene attendance log the cop held on a clipboard, and slipped under the tape. The door to room 7 was open, and light from inside spilled out. The sound of an electric harp also wafted from the room, and that told Bosch that Art Donovan had caught the case. The crime scene tech always brought a portable radio with him, and it was always tuned to The Wave, a New Age music channel. Donovan said the music brought a soothing calm to a scene where people had killed or been killed. Harry walked through the door, holding a handkerchief over his mouth and nose. It didn't help. The odor that was like no other assaulted him as soon as he passed the threshold. He saw Donovan on his knees, dusting fingerprint powder onto the dials of the air conditioner unit in the wall below the room's front and only window.
"Cheers,"
Donovan said. He was wearing a painter's mask to guard against the odor and the intake of the black powder. "In the bathroom." Bosch took a look around, quickly, since it was likely he would be told to leave as soon as the suits discovered him. The room's queen-sized bed was made with a faded pink coverlet. There was a single chair with a newspaper on it. Bosch walked over and noted that it was The Times, dated 6 days earlier. There was a bureau and mirror combination to the side of the bed. On the top of it was an ashtray with a single butt pressed into it after being half-smoked. There was also a .38 special in a nylon boot holster, a wallet, and a badge case. These last three had been dusted with the black fingerprint powder. There was no note on the bureau, the place Harry would have expected it to be. "No, no," he said, more to himself than Donovan.
"Nope, nothing in the bathroom either. Have a look. That is, if you don't mind losing your Christmas dinner."
Harry looked down the short hallway that went to the rear off the left side of the bed. The bathroom door was on the right, and he felt reluctance as he approached. He believed there wasn't a cop alive who hadn't thought at least once of turning his own hand cold. He stopped at the threshold. The body sat on the dingy white floor tile, its back propped against the tub. The first thing to register on Bosch was the boots, gray snakeskins with bulldog heels. Moore had worn them the night they had met for drinks. One boot was still on the right foot, and he could see the manufacturer's symbol, an S, like a snake, on the worn rubber heel. The left boot was off and stood upright next to the wall. The exposed foot, which was in a sock, had been wrapped in a plastic evidence bag. The sock had once been white, Bosch guessed, but now it was grayish, and the limb was slightly bloated. On the floor next to the door jamb was a 20-gauge shotgun with side-by-side barrels. The stock was splintered along the bottom edge. A 4-inch-long sliver of wood lay on the tile and had been circled with a blue crayon by Donovan or one of the detectives. Bosch had no time to deliberate on these facts. He just tried to take it all in. He raised his eyes the length of the body. Moore was wearing jeans and a sweatshirt. His hands were dropped at his sides. His skin was gray wax. The fingers, thick with putrefaction, the forearms bulging like Popeye's, Bosch saw a misshapen tattoo on the right arm, a devil's grinning face below a halo. The body was slumped back against the tub, and it almost appeared that Moore had rolled his head back as if to dip it into the tub, maybe to wash his hair. But Bosch realized it only looked that way because most of the head was simply not there. It had been destroyed by the force of the double-barrel blast. The light blue tiles that enclosed the tub area were awash in dried blood. The brown drip trails all went down into the tub. Some of the tiles were cracked, where shotgun pellets had struck. Bosch felt the presence of someone behind him. He turned into the stare of Assistant Chief Irvin Irving. Irving was wearing no mask and holding no rag to his mouth and nose.
"Evening, Chief."
Irving nodded and said, "What brings you here, Detective?" Bosch had seen enough to be able to put together what had happened. He stepped away from the threshold, moved around Irving, and walked toward the front door. Irving followed. They passed two men from the medical examiner's office who were wearing matching blue jumpsuits. Outside the room, Harry threw his handkerchief into a trash can brought to the scene by the cops. He lit a cigarette and noticed that Irving was carrying a manila file in his hand.
"I picked it up on my scanner," Bosch said. "Thought I'd come out since I'm supposed to be on call tonight. It's my division. It's supposed to be my call."
"Yes. Well, when it was established who was in the room, I decided to move the case to Robbery Homicide Division immediately. Captain Grupa contacted me. I made the decision."
"So it's already been established that's more in there?"
"Not quite." He held up the manila file. "I ran by records and pulled his prints. They will be the final factor, of course. There is also the dental, if there's enough left, but all other appearances lead to that conclusion. Whoever's in there checked in under the name Rodrigo Moya, which was the alias Moore used in Bang, and there's a Mustang parked behind the motel that was rented under that name. At the moment, I don't think there is much doubt here among the collective investigative team."
Bosch nodded. He had dealt with Irving before, when the older man was a deputy chief in command of the Internal Affairs Division. Now he was an AC, one of the top three men in the department, and his purview had been extended to include IAD, Narcotics Intelligence and Investigation, and all detective services. Harry momentarily debated whether he should risk pushing the point about not getting the first call.
"I should have been called," he said anyway. "It's my case. You took it away before I even had it."
"Well, Detective, it was mine to take and give away. Wouldn't you agree? There is no need to get upset. Call it streamlining. You know Robbery Homicide handles all officer deaths. You'd have had to pass it to them eventually. This saves time. There is no ulterior motive here other than expediency. That's the body of an officer in there. We owe it to him and his family, no matter what the circumstances of his death are, to move quickly and professionally."
Bosch nodded again and looked around. He saw an RHD detective named Sheehan in a doorway below the monthly RATS sign near the front of the motel. He was questioning a man of about 60, who was wearing a sleeveless T-shirt despite the evening chill, and chewing a sodden cigar stump. The manager.
"Did you know him?" Irving asked.
"Moore? No, not really. I mean, yes, I knew him. We worked the same division, so we knew each other. He was on night shift mostly, working the streets. We didn't have much contact."
Bosch did not know why, in that moment, he decided to lie. He wondered if Irving had read it in his voice. He changed the subject.
"So, it's, suicide. Is that what you told the reporters?"
I did not tell the reporters a thing. I talked to them, yes, but I said nothing about the identity of the body in this room, and will not until it is officially confirmed. You and I can stand here and say we are pretty sure that it is Calexico Moore in there, but I won't give that to them until we've done every test, dotted every I on the death certificate."
He slapped the manila file hard on his thigh. "This is why I pulled his personnel file, to expedite. The prints will go with the body to the medical examiner."
Irving looked back toward the door of the motel room.
"But you were inside, Detective Bosch, you tell me."
Bosch thought a moment. Is this guy interested, or is he just pulling my chain? This was the first time he had dealt with Irving outside of the adversarial situation of an internal affairs investigation. He decided to take a chance.
"Looks like he sits down on the floor by the tub, takes off his boot, and pulls both triggers with his toe. I mean, I assume it was both barrels, judging by the damage. He pulls the triggers with his toe, the recoil, throws the shotgun into the door jamb, splintering off a piece of the stock. His head goes the other way, onto the wall and into the tub. Suicide."
"There you go," Irving said. "Now I can tell Detective Sheehan that you concur, just as if you had gotten the first call out. No reason for anybody to feel left out."
"That's not the point, Chief."
"What is the point, Detective? That you can't go along to get along? that you do not accept the command decisions of this department? I am losing my patience with you, Detective, something I had hoped would never happen to me again.
Irving was standing too close to Bosch, his wintergreen breath puffing right in his face. It made Bosch feel pinned down by the man, and he wondered if it was done on purpose. He stepped back and said, "But no note."
"No note yet. We still have some things to check."
Bosch wondered what. Moore's apartment and office would have been checked when he first turned up missing. Same with his wife's home. What was left? Could Moore have mailed a note to somebody? It would have arrived by now. When did it happen?
Hopefully we'll get an idea from the autopsy tomorrow morning. But I am guessing he did it shortly after he checked in, 6 days ago. In his first interview, the manager said Moore checked in 6 days ago and hadn't been seen outside the room since. This jibes with the condition of the room, the condition of the body, the date on the newspaper.
The autopsy was tomorrow morning. That told Bosch that Irving had this one greased. It usually took 3 days to get an autopsy done, and the Christmas holiday would back things up even further. Irving seemed to know what he was thinking.
The acting chief medical examiner has agreed to do it tomorrow morning. I explained there would be speculation in the media that would not be fair to the man's wife or the department. She agreed to cooperate. After all, the acting chief wants to become the permanent chief. She knows the value of cooperation.
Bosch didn't say anything.
So we will know then. But nobody, the manager included, saw Sergeant Moore after he checked in 6 days ago. He left specific instructions that he was absolutely not to be disturbed. I think he went ahead and did it shortly after checking in.
So why didn't they find him sooner?
He paid for a month in advance. He demanded no disturbances. A place like this, they don't offer daily maid service anyway. The manager thought he was a drunk who was either going to go on a binge or try to dry out. Either way, a place like this, the manager can't be choosy. A month? That's $600. He took the money. And they made good on their promise not to go to room 7 until today, when the manager's wife noticed that Mr. Moya's car, the Mustang, had been broken into last night. That and, of course, they were curious. They knocked on his door to tell him, but he didn't answer. They used a passkey. The smell told them what was happening as soon as they opened the door. Irving said that Moya had set the air conditioner on its highest and coldest level to slow decomposition and keep the odor contained in the room. Wet towels had been laid across the floor at the bottom of the front door to further seal the room.
"Nobody heard the shot?" Bosch asked.
"Not that we found. The manager's wife is nearly deaf, and he says he didn't hear anything. They live in the last room on the other side. We've got stores on one side, an office building on the other. They all close at night. Alley behind. We are going through the registry and will try to track other guests that were here the first few days Moore was, but the manager says he never rented the rooms on either side of Moore's. He figured Moore might get loud if he was detoxing cold turkey. And, Detective, it is a busy street. Bus stop right out front. It could have been that nobody heard a thing. Or if they heard it, didn't know what it was."
After some thought, Bosch said, "I don't get renting the place for a month. I mean, why? If the guy was going to off himself, why try to hide it for so long? Why not do it and let them find your body and the story?"
"That's a tough one," Irving said. "Near as I can figure it, he wanted to cut his wife a break."
Bosch raised his eyebrows. He didn't get it.
"They were separated," Irving said. "Maybe he didn't want to put this on her during the holidays. So he tried to hold up the news a couple weeks, maybe a month."
That seemed pretty thin to Bosch, but he had no better explanation at the moment. He could think of nothing else to ask at the moment. Irving changed the subject, signaling that Bosch's visit to the crime scene was over.
We hope you enjoyed this free preview of The Black Ice, Book 2 in the Harry Bosch series. To keep the story going, get the complete book today.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.